very happy today to have as our colloquium speaker Professor Eduardo Martin Martinez, who is, of course, our colleague here in Waterloo. He's an associate professor in the Applied Math Department at Waterloo, and also with affiliations with, I think, the Physics Department and the Institute for Quantum Computing, and also with PI. He got his master's and PhD in Madrid, and then was a Banting Fellow, did his postdoc as a Banting Fellow here in Canada, and now, as I say, is an associate professor at Waterloo. He's been a recipient of many awards, including the Ontario Early Researcher Award and the John Charles Polonyi Prize. And generally speaking, he's an expert in relativistic quantum information, that is, the still relatively young field of trying to marry quantum information with relativity. So that's part of what he'll tell us about today.
Thank you.
So take it away whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction and for the invitation to give this this colloquium. I can move this out of the way. It's a pleasure for me. Like, it's nice to be able to talk about this topic, which is a pretty cool topic that has an interesting history. So today we're going to talk about quantum energy teleportation. And quantum energy teleportation is the brainchild of, I wrote this, we will discuss a little bit the headline is good or not, or things like that, right? But this is the brainchild of Masahiro Hota. This is actually written by Masahiro Hota. If you know Japanese or Chinese in this case, you would understand as well. We use for the vacuum, the quantum vacuum. Masahiro Hota in 2008 had an idea. We will talk about it. And I think it's about time it gets the recognition that it deserves. I was very happy to hear that they were writing about quantum energy teleportation. And in particular, I'm going to tell you about several things regarding quantum energy teleportation. The one thing I want to give, though, I want to give props to be honest, to Charlie Wood. Even though the title, the headline is, you know, sensationalism is a part of selling to people, to some people, interest on these things, right? Of course, you will see that it's not really pulling energy out of nothing, as we will discuss, but it's almost as interesting. The article is really good, so I want to give props to Charlie Wood. He really did a really good job checking with everybody, double-checking, writing text that is as accurate as you can be while at the same time being popular science friendly. He's a really good writer, and again, I just wanted to say good job, Charlie. That's a really good job. Anyway, let's begin. So, little outline. I don't know if I'll have time to finish everything because I realize that there are so many things that I would love to tell you about that I consider cool, but time is finite, as we know. And within the space-time domain of this talk, I'm not sure if I'll get to the last point. We'll see. I'll try. But at least we're gonna talk a little bit about thermodynamics and quantum energy teleportation, or in particular about the notion of strong-local passivity. Then I'm gonna guide you through a very simple example of application of quantum energy teleportation protocol. Then we're gonna discuss a little bit applications in practice to algorithmic cooling. And then, so which is fridge, make a quantum fridge in a way, and we'll discuss more what it means. I'll talk about the experiment we, quote unquote, did. I do quote unquote because although, of course, I'm an author in that paper, I did not go to the lab and do the experiment. That was the person who actually physically did it was Himan Katyar. And Nayeli was closely working there as well. And then that's from Ray Laflamme's group. I was the theoreticians who try to convince them of the crazy ideas that we should do this in the lab. So that I did very well, I think, because the experiment happened. All right, let's talk about thermodynamics. This is a stock photo, so it's free for use. There's no credit. All right, so let's talk about the passivity of thermostates. Well, thermostates are passive. So what do I mean? Think of a many-body system, right? I'm going to talk about passivity of those states, so saying no unitary operations can have a negative energy cost. So if I do a unitary operation on the system, that's going to have a positive energy cost. They're going to have to work, which makes sense. Second principle, second law of thermodynamics, you cannot really extract any work from a thermal bath, from a thermal reservoir, only one. Makes sense. Now, in particular, among a particular subclass of unitary operations, you have local unitary operations, which, of course, are passive as well, right? Not going to give you any work. It's going to cost you positive energy to do. By the way, you have any questions at any point, please do interrupt, okay? I don't want to lose anybody, and I think it's cool. I prefer to discuss than to get to the end. All right, so how about generic operations? And by generic operations, okay, not necessarily unitary, what about CPTP maps in general? Okay, so we do something to the system, maybe we touch the system, things like that, that are open quantum system processes, if you want. So you have a map that maps the original thermal density operator of the system to some other density matrix and the operator. And the idea is, okay, what if you do, you couple a system to a thermal bath, right? In general, if it's not a unitary operation, will it be always positive, the cost? Well, the answer is, well, not in general. We know one thing, right? We know that if we touch, imagine that you have a very hot system, right? And then you touch it. Think of the sun. I always use the sun, for example, because the sun happens to have the right energy gap for visible light, which is what ions, trapped ions, have as well. Anyway, you touch the sun, and it's very hot. And if you wait a little bit, you're going to get burned. Agreed? I don't think anybody would discuss that. That's not controversial. But that's not really, you see, that is definitely a positive operation that's not unitary. You are exchanging information with the sun by touching it. But it's also non-local, you see. You get an energy flow. By the touch, you establish an energy flow from the system to your hand. It's involving a lot of dynamics of the system that allows the system to really allow you to know more about the system than just local information. You are letting the system evolve internally, and there's an energy flow that goes to you. So this is not touching the sun and waiting for a while. It's not a local operation. You're not interacting only with one subsystem of the sun. Make sense? Even you, roughly speaking? Yeah, you are interacting with one, but you're allowing the whole system to know about your touch.
Yes.
That's what I mean. So the operation, the channel, will actually involve the states of this as well. So in that sense, the channel is not local. That's what I mean. It's not a channel from this. What I mean by local is that the channel definitely is dependent on the state of this. So it's non-local if you wait for a while. If you wait for a while, if this is very cold, it's going to be very different than if this is very hot. You understand. Sorry, what's that? Non-local in the sense, okay, maybe I shouldn't say non-local. What I mean is that definitely the channel involves not only one subsystem where you're doing the contact. Okay? Okay, so, question, another question. Can we extract energy by locally, and what I mean locally, let me actually make it more concrete. Locally in space and time, in the sense that I'm not going to wait a long time. I'm not going to interact with a big chunk of the system. I'm going to interact only locally. My interaction is only going to couple to one subsystem, and it's going to be very short in time. Maybe that's a better way to characterize the notion of locality I want here. So I want a quantum interaction. Imagine that I have a cold hand, and that cold hand is touching a very hot system, like that. Very fast. I touch the sun very fast. Make sense? The question, will the hand get burnt? As in, like, will you be able to extract energy from that touch? Well, the answer to that is that not in general. You can, in fact, get colder. Even if your hand is really cold, you can't get colder by touching the sun. And the idea is, in particular, this is the notion in this paper, strong local passivity. These papers establish a sufficient condition for strong local passivity, which is very interesting. Now, if the ground state of the system contains max rank entanglement, again, max rank entanglement doesn't mean maximum entanglement, it means max rank, as in this means the composition involves the whole Hilbert space of the system, then there exists a critical temperature, T star, that is larger than zero, for which if the temperature of the system is below this T star, it is not possible to extract work from the system through any local CPTP map. Make sense? So operations that only involve touching the system. That's the notion of strong local passivity. Now, in these papers, we're given the sufficient conditions and very insightful examples, showing some collaborators here with these people. Alvaro Martín Alhambra, who's currently visiting Perimeter, by the way, if you want to talk with him. Giorgio Stilaris, Nayeli, Rodrigo Briones, and Jamie Sikora. He used to be a postdoc here at Perimeter. We wrote a paper where we actually show the sufficient and necessary and sufficient conditions. I'm not going to get into the details of that. I'm just going to add it there if you want to check it. But yeah, there's the important thing here is enough with this, right? For a system whose ground state contains mass rack entanglement, there is a temperature T star for which for any temperature below that critical temperature, it's not possible to extract energy from the system by means of any local CPTP map. And that's what we call strong local passivity. Okay? Any questions so far?
Okay, so just is the canonical example, if the state is a thermal state, then the temperature is the temperature of that state?
Yeah. So if think of a thermal state, so this is an example reduced only to thermal states. Of course, there are more states that are non-thermal and still are strong local passive. That's also what we kind of study here. But yeah, for thermal states in particular, if you have that the zero temperature state has max rank entanglement, then there always exists a positive T star for which going a thermal state for Gibbs state below this temperature will be strong local passive. So it's impossible to locally extract energy by touching. A particular example, by the way, is of course the ground state itself, which wouldn't be surprising. You cannot really extract energy from the ground state no matter what, because it's the ground state. So if you touch the ground state, the best you can do is leave it the same. Or if it's degenerate, make some transformation in the degenerate subspace, right? Or increases energy because it's the ground state. Make sense? All right. Max rank entanglement means that Schmidt's decomposition is full, covers the whole full Hilbert space. So the entanglement is not localized in some subspace of the Hilbert space. If it were a lattice, for example, it means that the ground state is entangled, but there's entanglement between this and that, this and that, this and that, this and that. This is not a very stringent condition. Imagine a lattice of qubits or harmonic oscillators, first neighbors interaction, that's enough. Okay? So basically, almost every many-body quantum system would have that. Almost. All right, so the point here is here, if the system is at a temperature that is below T star, by touching it, you are actually either doing nothing to it in terms of energy flow or putting energy into the system because the system is strong local passive. It's kind of trivial for the ground state, right? Because if you touch the ground state, you have to be putting energy into it. But it's also true for thermal state at some finite temperature below this T star. T star can be computed. It's all constructive. So if you want to take a look at those works, very recommended. So yeah, you can get cold by touching the sun if you are really fast, really local in space and time when you touch the sun. All right. The idea of QET is that you can break local passivity by allowing LOCC. So something could be strong local passive, but if you allow now two people to do local operations and give them the ability to communicate, you can break strong local passivity. So I'm going to show an example, right? But I have here kind of the punchline, but that's also driven for the ground state. So we will see a little bit. So this is a caricature of that, and I'll do an example. So you have system A and B that are in a state, say that in the ground state that is entangled. The idea is that A carries out a POVM. Then the result of that POVM generates some classical information that is transmitted to B. And then B uses that classical information to act locally on the system and extract energy. Okay, even unitary in that case. This is the model that is called minimal QET. I'll give you a little walk. For the full details, I'm going to do it in the quantum info lectures in the PSI. Of course, we will do all the calculations in detail. For here, I'm just a sketch. So this is called minimal QET. It's one of the simplest examples. Don't worry too much about, we'll say we have a Hamiltonian H. We have two systems, right, H, A and B. And we have some local Hamiltonians, and we have some interaction term. The local Hamiltonians is saying, yeah, you have an energy gap between them, and between it's like two qubits, so between the zero state and the one state. Between the zero and one state of B, but of course we also add some interaction. Now notice that there's a multiple of the identity added here that obviously does nothing. It's a multiple of the identity, but makes the math. This is, if it's not there, it's okay. You get the same result. Or it's just an origin of potential here. But makes the math much easier to have this multiple of the identity here. That's why I have it. Okay? Much nicer. Anyway, so this F, I make it this ratio between the gap of the local systems and the gap plus the coupling strength. All right, so we can compute the ground state for that particular Hamiltonian. And the ground state looks like that. Notice, by the way, the sign here that might be very contrary to what you use in quantum info. In relativistic quantum information, that's very common. And the reason typically is that you want the zero to be the lower energy state. Anyway, conventions. Don't bother too much about them. In quantum info, typically that's the eigenstate minus one. Eigenstate with eigenvalue minus one. That's, again, conventions. Let's just keep that clear. So the ground state looks like this, which is obviously entangled, and it's max rank entangled. In particular, it covers the whole field of space, which is not that difficult because those are two-dimensional systems. And of course, you can tell here that if F were zero, that would be the maximal entangled state. So there is entanglement in the ground state. All right, so let's do a protocol. First, we start from the ground state. Then Alice carries out a projective measurement. You obviously don't need projective measurements for this. It's just because it's the simplest example, OK? But Alice carries out a projective measurement on her qubit. Then the result of that measurement is announced to Bob. And then Bob carries out a unitary operation that depends on the result of the measurement. Very simple. And we're going to see that the average energy cost of doing that operation is less than zero. All right? So let's see. So Alice carries out a POVM on sigma x. She measures sigma x of her qubit. And she just obtains the outcome alpha. Alpha is a bit of information, if you want. Contains a bit of information. It's a plus one or minus one. Then the action of the measurement, of course, is a projective measurement. So it's this projector that projects the state either to the zero or the one, depending on the result of the measurement. And this is the post-measurement state, just updating with the usual update rule. Now, if we were to repeat this many times, right, if we repeat this projection on some of identical setups, we obtain that the post-measurement state would look like this, right, where PA is just the probability as I have there. And then, of course, you can compute how costly in energy is that step. Doing this projection will cost you some energy, obviously. So when Alice does the projection, she's putting energy into the system that is coupled, all right? Locally on A for now, but it's putting energy into the system. So you can compute the difference in the expectation of the... This is the full Hamiltonian, not just the local ones. Of course, you need to consider also the interaction part, right? So this is the total Hamiltonian. So you compute the difference of the expectations of the Hamiltonian. So that is the average energy cost of doing the projection, which happens to be F, which is larger than zero. OK? Now, Alice sends the classical bit of information to Bob, and Bob carries out this unitary operation on his qubit, where we choose these angles to be like this. Okay, so it depends on alpha. You can tell that it's doing either nothing or sigma y, depending on the value of alpha. Or nothing, not nothing. It's doing identity minus I sigma y or plus I sigma y with some coefficients, right, depending on the result of the measurement. And of course, that's the unitary operation and on the state after the projection. So the state, again, is updated by the fact that Alice is the projection. Then Bob does the unitary. All right. And then, of course, we are doing an ensemble of these operations. If you do an ensemble of these operations, this is the state that you get after the unitary operation by Bob. So far, so good. All right. So the energy cost, if you compute the energy cost of that step, what didn't I have? I don't have the definition. Oh, that's so sad. So the energy cost, this EUB, is of course the same as before, is the trace of rho after the unitary Hamiltonian minus the trace of rho after the measurement Hamiltonian, okay? So it's the energy difference between the two steps. And then you can see from this expression, if you believe my math or my arithmetic, it's not mine actually, that's Masahiro Hota's, right? But it's, I also done it. So, and this is double checked. Okay, of course, true. But I didn't do the details of the math, but one can see that this can get negative. And in particular, for a small theta, you get a negative value. That negative value means that the cost of doing this unitary operation on B is actually negative. You're getting energy out of the system. And of course, you get less energy than Alice put. This is less than F. So you always get less energy than Alice put in with the projective measurement. So you are not recovering. It's called teleportation in a way because now B extracts the energy, whereas Alice has put energy there by the measurement. Makes sense? Now, here's the point that makes it non-trivial, and I hope that this is clear. One could think that, well, if Alice is doing a projective measurement on A, she's putting energy into the system. That energy will propagate to B, and maybe that's what you're extracting. You have propagation of energy from A to B. But the answer is actually no, not really, no. If you compute, didn't I have that? Sorry. No, I didn't, okay. If you compute time evolution, okay, if you compute time evolution of the system, imagine that Alice makes the projection. Right after the projection is made, Alice puts energy there, and you allow the system to evolve freely now, you get that the expectation of energy in B, by the way, with this choice of F is nice because the expectation of the exchange energy is zero, which is nice, allows us to talk about the local energy without worrying too much about the term V, which you cannot do usually, but here is nice in this particular example. So you see that the local energy on B starts being zero, and it actually grows with a time scale that is 1 over k. So, of course, k is the coupling. So, of course, you know that, right? If you have a spring and two masses, if you have a lot of energy in mass number one, vibrates a lot, it will eventually make B vibrate. But if you have a very stiff spring, if you have a bar, it will move instantaneously. If you have a spring that is very low coupling, it will take a long time for the other one to start vibrating. The velocity at which the energy propagates is the inverse of the coupling strength. And that is unrelated to the speed of the classical channel that you use to send information from A to B. In particular, you could assume that the velocity of information traveling from A to B is much faster than the inverse of the coupling strength. And in that case, the energy never travels from A to B. That's why it's called teleportation. The name teleportation comes from the fact that I'm measuring A, then I send the classical information to B, and B locally in a state, because it's too fast, the state locally still looks like the ground state for B. B would not be able to tell measuring locally if this is not the ground state, because the perturbation made on A has had no time to propagate from A to B. Then B locally would look like the ground state, but now he knows what to do to what it looks like the ground state locally to extract energy from. Make sense? Is that clear? That model is clear? It's a very simple model. So there's some intuition. Again, intuition, right? On average, if you do operations on B without knowing anything, sometimes you're going to get energy out, sometimes you're going to get energy in. But on average, you're going to actually have to put energy into it because it was the ground state. However, if there's entanglement, fluctuations on A are going to be correlated with fluctuations on B. If somebody measures A and gets some information about the fluctuations, if you want, in the ground state, can send that information to B. And B knows now cleverly how to push what looks like the ground state to recover energy from it. A little bit of intuition. Clear. I hope that it's established. At least what I want to establish is that energy does not really travel from A to B. Information does. Oh, Alvaro's here now. Okay. I talked about you a second ago. All right. So this is QET. Of course, QET is not reduced to operating in systems of 2 qubits. You can do that in many body systems. You can do that in quantum field theory that we will discuss last. In fact, it was first introduced in QFT. But let's talk about an application algorithmic cooling that historically is something that we did first. Algorithmic cooling is cool. Again, pun not intended here, but imagine that you want to cool down. Imagine you have a set of qubits, right? Imagine those are qubits, and you want to do quantum info or something like that with it. With this one, in particular, this one I want to be very pure as possible. But unfortunately, these are not coupled, okay? They are free. Unfortunately, this is in a thermal state. Very sad. But imagine that I want to cool this down, and I have access to a thermal bath that has some temperature. The question is, can I cool down this qubit? Of course, I know that I can cool it down at least to the temperature of the thermal bath, right? I just put it in touch with the thermal bath. It will eventually thermalize if I can manage thermal contact. But the question is, can I actually, using as a resource the thermal bath and the ability to do non-local unitaries here, can I reduce the temperature of this below the temperature of the thermal bath? So this is cheating. We're going to use something quantum about this to try to cheat this and cool this qubit down colder than this. Okay? That's a principle of algorithmic cooling. Thank you, Nayeli, by the way. This is great to Nayeli, because this is Nayeli's animations that we're going to see now. Feedback algorithmic cooling. Okay, so we have our thermal state of qubits. The first thing that we do is something called entropy compression. So what is that? Entropy compression is, well, I'm going to apply non-local unitaries to move all the entropy from away from this guy as much as possible. Let's put all the entropy the closest possible to this guy, to this qubit. Make sense? I can do it because I can have non-local unitaries that exchange information between the qubits. Now, I'm going to refresh, for example, the last qubit. I'm going to refresh it with the thermal bath, put it in thermal contact. And now I have a new set of qubits. One of them is cold, as cold as the thermal bath. One of them is colder than before, the coldest of the lot. But I can now repeat entropy compression. Now I have more capacity to put entropy here, because now this one is colder. So you repeat it again. And indeed, you can achieve, by doing that, you can achieve this guy being colder than this guy. You keep repeating that until you reach a stationary point. Nageli and Ray found actually those stationary points and have a lot of work on this. And the algorithm that is optimal for a set of qubits that are not coupled and you have access to a thermal bath that you're allowed to reset with is this one called PPA-HVAC. That is the optimal algorithm. I'm not going to get the details of that. I mean, the important thing is that there is an algorithm that is optimal and it's called PPA-HVAC. It's pretty simple, actually. Now, imagine now that I want to cool down systems that are not decoupled from other systems. I have systems in interaction. Now, it's a bit of an issue here. Because if I have system in interaction, if I cool down the system somehow, if I manage to cool it down, put it close to absolute zero, then I'm going to have ground state entanglement in general because their system is coupled. So an individual qubit will not be pure. It's going to have some ground state entanglement with the rest of the system, and that will make the state of that qubit non-pure. Please.
At the start of that algorithm, all
you needed
to know about the system on the left was that it was in the thermal state?
Yeah, or not even, well, it's qubits, right? So, yeah, not even really. Everything is in a thermal state, in a way.
The only thing you know about the density matrix is the density matrix, which is the thermal.
That's right. Okay, so. Sorry about this. Animations take a while. Yeah. All right, now, if we have interaction, the point is that cooling it down to absolute zero would be bad. Cooling a system of interacting qubits to absolute zero does very little for the individual qubits. They're going to be in a mixed state. They're not going to be pure. Above all, if the interaction is strong, then they're going to be even less pure. Okay, we can do interaction with the environment so that we break the entanglement, as in we let only one of the qubits interact with the entanglement, do an entanglement breaking interaction. Again, that's adding additional mixedness when you break the entanglement. We can apply local operation on the subsystem maybe to try to cool down the qubit, but then that's a problem, right? Because, the ground state is probably strong local passive, like many of those interacting systems' ground states are. So how do we cool down a part of that interacting system? One of the suggestions I had, well, let's use QET. QET extracts energy. But instead of optimizing for energy extraction, we can optimize for entropy extraction. It's very similar to the same principle. So this is work with Nageli, Achim Kemp, and Ray LaFlamme. And we studied this kind of family of Hamiltonians. And in particular, you can tell, depending on the temperature, what is the initial purity of one individual qubit in the ground state, or not in the ground state, in a thermal state, right? Before, depend for different values, this is the coupling strength over the gap energy. So for different values, I don't have here the same units. But this is the coupling strength over the gap. And you can tell, right, that if the coupling strength, you can tell here, but because there's an interaction, there's some ground state, there's some ground state beta. There's some ground state entanglement that you can tell when beta goes to infinity, right? Initial purity. Yeah, of course, it's the opposite because it's the purity. And then we apply a QET algorithm to purify one single qubit, and we end up with a final purity that is way above. Now, this probably means nothing. Of course, it works better the stronger the coupling. You start with very little purity, and you end up with a lot of purity. It's like QET is using as a resource there for the ground state, the entanglement, or the correlations in the system. But the interesting thing, perhaps, is that if you compare it with an analog PPA protocol, PPA HVAC protocol, you get that for interacting system is extremely better. So this is comparing on equal footing, which means we allow them to have the same number of resources. For PPA algorithmic cooling, we allow them to have the same number of qubits to play with than we need for QET. We need three at least for QET. Anyway, this is just to say that, of course, you can use the same principle. I didn't want to talk much about this. You can use the same principle, a lot of belief in this, I think, because I didn't really give you good arguments. But it's based on the same principle as QET. You have interacting systems and you want to cool down a subset of the interacting systems. The entanglement on the ground state is going to get in the way, but you can battle it the same way you battle strong local passivity with QET. Make sense? All right. So we've seen that QET is a cool thing. Maybe you're not convinced, but at least I tried my best to convince you. The problem with that is that there was no experimental proof of that. It's all theory. Again, it's very simple theory, as you can tell, right? But there was no experiment made about QET. So I approached on that the same way for the algorithmic cooling, a race group. They do experiments in nuclear magnetic resonance. And there's a paper with Nayeli, Himan Katyar, and Ray. It's been impressed for a long time. PRL, because proofs, you know, take sometimes a long time. But the idea is that we use, actually, is this molecule, right? I think it is the same molecule. Isn't it, Ajeli? No. It looks like it might be the same molecule. Let's see, number of carbons, three. Number of carbons, four, yeah. But in this molecule, with nuclear magnetic resonance, you can actually implement almost any Hamiltonian that you want between them. Not really, there are some limitations, but you can actually implement Hamiltonians by playing with the radio pulses that you send to prepare unitype. First of all, you prepare the ground state of this Hamiltonian, that's what you can prepare. And then you prepare the unitaries that are equivalent to every step in QET. Now, we're gonna do here a variation on the transmission of classical information. The transmission of information here is gonna be quantum, in the sense that there we go. What we use here is an ancillary system. We first prepare the state, and the state is the ground state of the Hamiltonian. Then we have here the interaction of qubit A with an ancillary system. That ancillary system is the one that gathers the information about A locally. And then this ancillary system now is coupled to B. I haven't discussed it, but of course, you can have A log QC assisted QET as well. You just need LOCC, but you can do it with LOQC. And that's the one we implemented here, which is more general than the, in general, is more general than the LOCC one, because LOCC is a particular case of LOQC in this protocol. Now, the idea is that all these elements can be implemented in the lab. I'm the wrong person to ask about the experiment, but you can ask Nayeli. But what I can tell you, though, is that when you do the experiment, the results almost nails the theory. So this is the ideal scenario where you do everything just with assuming everything is nice and there's no decoherence and no other factors. Then you had the simulation, which is the theory model, but adding the noise and adding the decoherence that we know happens in those experimental apparatuses. And blue are the experimental points. You can tell that you indeed can extract energy from B. Agreed? So you see extraction of energy. Now, the question that you may ask is about whether this is QET. Ah, oh, sorry. Ah, sorry, first too much. So, is this QET? For it to be QET, to make sure that it's QET, you should not have allowed energy to travel from A to B freely by the free dynamics of the molecule, right? The molecule itself is going to let energy go. You do something on A, which is the measurement, that puts energy on A, and the energy on A will travel to B naturally, same as before. So one needs to make sure that you didn't allow enough time for the energy to travel from A to B. Keep in mind, let me put it like this. If you don't do the ancillary coupling, if you measure A and then you measure B, B will not feel anything. B is going to look like the ground state until you know you allow for enough time for the energy to propagate from A to B. So we need to make sure that this energy that we're seeing here, this energy that we are seeing here, this energy that is the extracted to the environment that we're seeing here. It's not coming from energy traveling from A to B. How you do that? Well, just count the time that it takes to do every step. We have a very conservative estimate. This is the total experiment duration. In fact, what is important, right, is the time that it takes for the coupling of the ancilla to travel to B and couple to B. But we added the extra time to B on the conservative side of the whole duration of the experiment, from the initial pulse that prepared to the final pulse that implements the last unitary. So if you add up all the times, the total experiment time duration is 37.6 milliseconds. And the energy propagation time on this system from A to B is actually 1 second. So we are about 200 times kind of okay. Like, this is much smaller. This number is much smaller than that. We are seeing energy. We are seeing energy being extracted from B much earlier than the time it takes for the energy to propagate from A to B. Therefore, we claim this is a proof of quantum energy teleportation. So far, so good? We're going pretty fast. Yeah.
I'm surprised to hear that the energy propagation time is so long. Why is there a way simple way
to propagate? Yeah, the couplings between A and B are very short, are very tiny. A almost is not coupled to B. Right? You can play with the couplings, and you can make the couplings really, really tiny. And remember that the time it takes for the energy to propagate is the inverse of the coupling strength. That's it. There's no more secret to it. Make sense? All right.
So you're saying energy can propagate between the electronic states much more quickly, but between the nuclear states, it's very...
That's correct. These are vibrational states of the nuclear, right? So. Make sense, everybody? Electric and vibrational, but yeah. All right. So I've told you about QETE. This is all the science. Oh, it's all science, huh? Don't get me wrong. But this is like the tangible science part of it. We can go to the speculative science part of it if you want. All right, so we have QET, which can activate I call it activating zero point energy, as in locally, what looks like the ground state. Now it's something that I can extract energy from. Okay, what about quantum field theory? We know in quantum field theory, even for the simplest, you have a free scalar field in flat space-time. You know that the ground state is an entangled state. Agreed? Can we pull the same trick? So, original paper, great for people. This is a paper called Engineering Negative Stress Energy Densities with Quantum Energy Teleportation. What we want to do is something like that. Like, this is Nico Funai. He used to be a PSI student, then PhD student in my group, and now is a postdoc in Melbourne. That's the kind of thing we want to do, to be able to prepare to use protocols of quantum info to generate distributions of stress energy density, hopefully allowing us to shape space-time, perhaps. We'll see. All right, we don't need much of this. We have general relativity. Just let's look at Einstein equations. Now, Einstein equations have a bit of a problem, per se. So relativity from the postulates of general relativity allow for very unpleasant solutions as well. There are solutions to Einstein equations that are pretty unpleasant. For example, naked singularities. Solutions present in naked singularities. For example, closed time-like curves. Those are a bit of a mess. For example, the Alcubierre reward drive, right? Bubbles of space-time that in principle could move in a way that apparently for somebody who is stationary with respect to coordinates at infinity, which is flat, so flat coordinates at infinity, is not moving at all, but yet, effectively, they look like they're moving faster than light. That's kind of things, right? So, back in the day, summarizing a lot, Penrose and Hawking came up with a series of extra conditions to add to general relativity for it to behave in a way that's physically acceptable. And those are called energy conditions. I have here just a description of the conditions as the motto. I didn't write them, right? But let's just go through them. The weak energy condition says there's no such thing as negative energy densities. The strong energy condition tells you gravity is only attractive. The dominant energy condition tells you energy must not flow faster than light. And the null energy condition tells us that the most difficult to interpret is, well, the only future-directed flow of stress energy is positive. Null flow of stress energy is positive. So it's in a way a limiting case of the weak energy condition. But some of them imply each other. You see the null is the most powerful in the sense that the null implies all the others. Sorry, if you violate the opposite. If you violate the null, you violate all the others. The weak is pretty powerful in what it forbids from happening as well. Now, if you violate at least the average version, so there's more conservative condition, which is, okay, average over regions of space-time. Instead of considering points, because those are a little bit ill, average over regions of space-time, it's called the average energy conditions. If you violate the null or the weak energy conditions, you can have these kind of solutions, Einstein equations. Things with wormholes, warp drives, screening, pretty exotic stuff. In fact, we know that we have observations that are kind of compatible with violations of some energy condition, depending on the sign of the cosmological constant. Yeah, go ahead.
You're talking about average.
Yes, average. For the violation of the average. Sorry about that. I wanted to have the average here, but yes, the violation of the average. I'm going to talk about only the violations of the average. Yeah. So, what was I saying? I lost a bit. Well, what I mean is that we call matter for which the stress energy density violates some of these conditions exotic matter. And for a while, I mean, it looks like both matter that we observe behaves like that. But we also know, we also know that quantum fields can violate energy conditions. In particular, here I have a result by Foran Fenning that indeed you can violate the average energy, weak energy condition. Of course, you cannot violate it as much as you want. I mean, you kind of can, depending on how. If you have a big region of space, then you can violate it a little. If it's a small region of space, then you can violate it quite a bit. Okay? So quantum field theory allows for violations of stress energy, of the average weak energy condition. Now, this is not new. I mean, from the 80s, 90s, people started publishing about accelerated mirrors, examples, where you accelerate mirrors and you create huge distributions of negative energy density by accelerating big mirrors. Now, the problem with that, though, is that that's not, if you imagine that you want to do an experiment in real life, and I want to see if I can create exotic matter or a quantum field distribution that violates the average weak energy condition, and I want to see how that gravitates. Imagine that I have really, really sensitive gravity sensors, which is something that people are working on and they're getting really, really good at. How can I do it? Then somebody can tell, well, like, get a mirror and accelerate it to brutal speeds, right? But that's not good because objects tend not to survive acceleration of that kind. A rigid object cannot be accelerated in general relativity. Well, it can if every point accelerates with a different acceleration, but then you need to keep the tension constant. You know that well, huh? You need to keep the tension constant. And that means that this would be internal cohesion forces that become need to be infinitely strong in the limit that it becomes relativistic, right? So it's very tough to, not to mention that it's a chunk of a mirror that you need to accelerate physically to create that. So that might not be the best idea. So that's why I write rather unphysical. Make sense? Okay, let's go to Masahiro Hota, 2008. Masahiro does this. He considers two atoms, a model as Andrew DeWitt detectors. And these two atoms are systems, quantum systems, that interact locally with the field. In that local interaction, what Masahiro does is that Alice couples only, it's in 1+1 dimensions, so in a two-dimensional space-time, he can do this. Alice couples only to left movers of the field. Okay? And Bob couples to the whole field. Then Alice makes a measurement with the atom coupled to the field, and then makes a projective measurement on the atom. The action of doing that is that, of course, the energy density around Alice is increased. Obviously, Alice is coupling something. It's a ground state. This is the renormalized stress energy density. Of course, we assume that the stress energy density in flat space-time for our field theory is zero, which is experimentally verified to the level of violations of Lorentz invariance for flat space-time, so very well, except for energies that could be comparable to quantum gravity. Zero-point energy doesn't gravitate, okay? Experimental fact, if you want. Now, Alice generates a distribution of energy around herself by doing that operation. But of course, Bob, this is a fully causal theory. Bob knows nothing about what Alice did. If Bob were to measure this, Bob measures the vacuum state. This looks locally like the vacuum state of the theory. Make sense? All right. Now, we let some time evolve, and the perturbation from Alice propagates to the left, because, again, Masahiro coupled Alice only to left movers, which is nice, because Masahiro wanted to show that energy does not propagate from A to B. And then that's why he really doesn't want that the thing that Alice did clutters what's going on here. It's a good choice. Then Alice sends classical information to Bob. Alice sends classical information to Bob that moves also at the speed of light, for example, or slower, but let's say at the speed of light. And then Bob does a local operation, and he proved that indeed, I mean, this is not a good representation because you also get a little bit, there's something called the quantum interest conjecture, which is not a conjecture for 1 plus 1 flats and 3 plus 1 flat, that tells you that if you create negative energy, you also have to create more positive energy, not only more positive energy than negative energy, which is obvious because it's the ground state. You cannot reduce the total energy. When you integrate the density, the total energy that you get should be above the ground state because it's the ground state. You cannot really reduce the total energy of the ground state. But not only that, you have to pay a little cost. So you need to increase, have a little positive energy here. So this is just a representation, okay? But yeah, he proves that Bob can extract, that's what he focused on in that paper, Bob can extract energy without energy, any energy carriers moving from A to B. Energy does not propagate from A to B. So Bob is extracting energy from what for him looks like the vacuum state. See what I mean? The perturbation of Alice never arrived to Bob. It looks like the vacuum, like nothing happened locally. And he's consuming the entanglement that is in the theory, in the ground state of the theory. Make sense? All right, so now, if your objective is extracting energy, then you're fine with this. That proves it. If your objective is to try to create exotic matter, then you have a bit of an issue. Why? Because the information, so in reality, you're going to be in 3 plus 1 dimensions. You're not going to couple to just left movers. You're going to couple to the full field, typically, for a physical interaction of an atom. Maybe you can engineer things putting a mirror. But in general, you're going to couple only. Mirrors tend to, if introduced not carefully, tend to break correlations. Things become cluttered. So, yeah, the information cannot travel faster. You remember that I told you in QET, to guarantee that QET, that information has to travel faster than the energy propagates from A to B. That doesn't happen here if you have a massless field. If you have a massless field, the perturbation from Alice will propagate towards Bob at the same speed or faster than the information. Now, you could tell me, well, you can use a massive field. You could. But the problem, then, of course, the perturbation is lower propagating. You know what the problem is with a massive field? That the correlations in the ground state decay exponentially with the distance. Whereas in a massless field, they don't. They decay polynomially with the distance. So there's way more resources. Remember that the resources we're using here is ground state entanglement. So we want to keep as much entanglement as possible. So if we can, we should better use a massless field. Make sense? So here I have the idealized case where you couple only to left moving modes. And here I have the less idealized case where Alice couples to the whole field. So the problem that you face is that you see Alice does the measurement, then the information is sent, but the information arrives. You see, for the Masahiro example, it's clean. Energy doesn't propagate that way. But for the full example, the information arrives at the same time or slower. Turns out that at the same time is the best you can do than the energy that Alice created. So if you really want to create energy, that's negative energy densities here, you're going to have to overcome not only the zero value, now the positive value, the bump that propagates from Alice to you. Make sense? It's a bit tougher. All right, so let's see what we do here. We're going to focus on, instead of looking at energy extracting, we're going to focus on engineering, so the state of the field, and in particular, the energy density. We're going to see the 3 plus 1 decays, and we're going to try to make concrete, within reason, the protocol, instead of using idealized systems. Okay, so the protocol is going to be like this. Alice measures the field by coupling an atom or an array of atoms to it. Alice measures the atom, which is, by non-relativistic, I mean, well, Alice is working in energy levels where relativity doesn't matter. The atom is at rest for the frame, the lab frame of Alice. Alice broadcasts then the result of the measurement to an agency of Bob's. And Bob's agents are going to use that information to prepare atoms themselves and couple them to the field where they live. Make sense? That's the protocol. Now, before doing the full protocol in 3 plus 1D, let's do first a toy model. And the toy model is going to be 1 plus 1D. And 1 plus 1D, things are nice, and I'll tell you why. So you have the system in an initial state that is separable between the qubit of Alice and the vacuum. And then, of course, you couple. We're doing, to simplify things, very fast interaction. This is an interaction of the atom very fast. You have the atom, if you want, in a Faraday cage, and you open it very fast and close it, something like that. All right, and then Alice teleports the qubit to Bob. You see, instead of sending classical information, Alice is sending quantum information in this protocol. We do it. Why? Because it's much easier to compute. So Alice is going to do LOQC for this example of 1 plus 1D. Okay? So it's going to send the full. It's basically, this is my atom is measured, now I send you the atom. So a regular teleport, not quantum teleportation, a regular teleportation protocol. Quantum teleportation protocol. It could be the atom put in a box and sent to box as well, above as well, if you want. If you want to think of it like that. All right. So then, didn't I say that? All right, and then Bob, sorry. And then Bob interacts after a time t, right? Interacts when the information arrives, when the qubit arrives, interacts with the field in a similar way. Now, for 1 plus 1 dimensions, the resulting, I have the 0,0 component of the stationary density here, you can tell right away what's going on. You have here, this is this new function of Alice, derivative. In this case, it's derivative coupling. This is the main function of Bob. So you can tell that you have bumps of energy where Bob coupled and where Alice coupled. So the coupling of Alice with the field and the coupling of Bob with the field creates bumps, positive bumps. This is positive. Positive bumps of energy. But you also have, because the entanglement present in the field, you also have things that we call QET terms. And by QET terms, things that don't have a definite signature, you see. This depends on the initial state of Alice. So you can find states of Alice for which this is negative. Okay? So that's why I call it QET term here. It's QET term because it can become negative. And maybe it can overcome this. I don't know. Make sense? That's a hint that it can overcome this. But it's mixing. You see, this is the entanglement part, the correlation part. This is mixing. That's mirroring, the spatial mirroring of Bob and the spatial mirroring of Alice, both of them. So maybe it can truly overcome this. It's literally not easy to tell at first sight if it will. Make sense? All right. So let's have a little simulation of what you get. So again, Alice couples to derivative coupling and has a Lorentzian mirroring in this case. So you can tell that this is the energy after Alice is coupling to the field. This is the energy density distribution in the field. So of course, Alice's center is zero. So she generates a bump, positive energy bump, once it couples to the field. Then we turn on dynamics, and then you see how the energy was 30, the axis rescaled, right? Half of the energy goes left, half of the energy goes right. And then we get to the point here. That's the point right before Bob is here, and Bob just received both. The information, if you want, the quantum information, the state of Alice's atom, and of course the energy packet that Alice created at the same time. Okay, Bob does this protocol. We see that right after the interaction. We see that. See how we scale up again? Because Bob has just dumped a lot of energy into the field because Bob coupled the atom to the field. Agreed? So we don't see much. This is not negative, huh? This is a resolution issue. We don't see negative energy here, right? Okay. But then let's wait a little bit, because we know that half of the energy is going to go left and half of the energy is going to go right. Let's see what happens. Well, look at that. Notice the rescaling of the axis. This is not. It's missing a 0.0, whatever. We have a bump of negative energy surrounded by positive energy in here when the left movers propagated to the left. Make sense? And you have quite a lot there. This is a zoom in of what happens, right? This is quite a lot. So you see that we have the quantum interest conjecture in action here. You get that you need some positive energy surrounded your negative energy. The further away the two would be, the more interest you have to pay, the more positive energy that you need. So it's good that it's very close to it. Make sense? Right. Let's try to do 3 plus 1 now. Now, problems that happen in 3 plus 1D. Well, number one, you see how I did it before? There were two atoms, right? It was Alice atom, and Alice quantum teleported the state of the atom A to the atom B. Now, you have an agency of bobs with many atoms. You can't do that anymore. And the reason is that, well, you have no cloning. You cannot really teleport your state to more than one partner. That's the best you can do. So you better do here an LOCC protocol instead of an LOQC. And finally, well, the math is really complicated in 3 plus 1D. All right, so we use a couple of tricks to do. Time is almost over, huh? Okay. We do a couple of tricks. So in the 3 plus 1D case, we're going to do a trick first. For computation purposes, we're going to assume that there's only one Bob. So Alice lives, has only one atom in the center. And Bob has only one atom that is smeared as a ring. This is a very non-local, very unphysical atom. This is saying that I have an atom that surrounds me, right? That is very unphysical. However, we have a proof that the mathematical, for the particular choices of states that we have, the mathematical, I'll just show you the circuit of the proof, but not the proof. The calculation with this mirroring is equivalent in some cases as a calculation where you actually have many atoms and you actually send the classical information. So on that you have, I'll show you the circuit equivalence, but you have to believe me because I'm not going to show you the proof of that. But the calculations are going to be done with two atoms, one that is centered here and one that is smeared in a ring around. By a ring, I mean a sphere around. Ring is the section. Make sense? All right. Oh yeah, this is the equivalence, but yeah, in the cases that AC, the original state is an eigenstate of sigma y, then the LOCC protocol gives the same final state as the LOQC, provided the final measurement sigma z give the same result. So you do, you know, there's a way to make them equivalent, and you have to believe me on this. I mean, the circuit is easy to check that it's the same, but of course, one thing is to claim it with the circuit, another one is to claim that it happens in the QFC. You have to believe me on that for now. All right. So let's do the 3D case. Alice measures the field by coupling an atom to it. Then Alice is measuring a non-relativistic atom. Alice broadcasts the result of the measurement to an agency of bobs. Again, remember the calculation we're going to do it at is at if Alice teleports her qubit to only one bob, that we are discussing is equivalent. And then Bob's agents use that information to prepare atoms and couple to the field. In this case, the smearing function of Bob is interpreted as the density distribution of atoms, its density of atoms for the system. So Bob, the magnitude of the smearing function is the density at a point of how many atoms you put. Like think of a gas, how many atoms of a gas per unit volume I have there. And tails of the shape of it is the gas distribution of those atoms. All right, so then you have the stress energy density, then you have similar terms, but then the terms are, oh, I didn't have them. I typically have a slide where I show you what each of these terms are, but it's very long and horrible. And that's a typo even, so it's not really helpful to show that. But hopefully you believe me that this is long and not worth showing. Every I here is integrals that are very long. Okay. So we use Gaussian smearing functions. Here I have, again, the smearing function of Alice. Here the smearing function of Bob, cross section. So you see there are spheres. So this is a view from a section, right? So this is where they are. Bob is around between 15 and 20. If you ask me, why did you put it between 15 and 20? Nico really likes odd weird numbers for things. He doesn't like to put like 5 or things like that. So that's his choice, which is okay. There's a reason for that when you do a lot of numerics, right? Just sometimes integers give you the right result, but you shouldn't trust it. Anyway, let's activate dynamics here. So Alice does her measurement, and there you go. You got that energy distribution. Of course, the thing here is that you're going to have some really problematic stuff because the problem is that distribution is spherically symmetric. So you have an outward propagating energy packet and an inward propagating energy packet that will collapse because it's very symmetric. So let's ignore the fact that we're sending an incoming wave from one position to a point. We're going to get a caustic if you want in there. Let's ignore that for a second because that's not relevant for us. Things, interesting things will happen here. All right, so after Alex's interaction, you get a reflection of the origin, right? So now you get everything propagating outwards, right? You get the initial wave, the reflective wave, and the reflective plus initial wave. And it's the derivative, remember, that's why you have these two minima, because it's derivative coupling. Anyway, energy density immediately prior to Bob's interaction. So you can tell that the energy now has arrived at the point where Bob is. And the information too. So Bob does the coupling of his detector now with the state of Alice, or again, does the coupling of each detector with the information received from Alice. And now we see a little bit of negative energy there. Now, you see how the axis is going down? Well, the current, this is because of dispersion, of course, going down as it propagates from here to here. It's 3D, so the energy is being spread in a volume, in a surface, rather. So it goes with the square of the distance. And now, of course, there's a radial ingoing part energy packet that is generated by Bob and goes in, and an outgoing packet that has this little bump, which we can zoom on. Let's see, victory, which is a tiny bit of negative energy right there. You see, this is not negative energy. This is, again, the zero that is just plotted like that with lack of resolution, the thick line problem. Anyway, so maybe if I show you that, you are not very impressed of what you can accomplish because it's a tiny speck of negative energy, right? And in fact, it becomes less because dispersion, again, this negative energy is being dispersed. How much negative energy can we put in if we optimize now? Well, you can rescale the cloud of atoms that you have. So you can rescale Alice, you can rescale Bob. So what I'm doing here is increasing the density of atoms that Alice and Bob have access to. And doing that scaling, the energy density scales with sigma to the n. So the total amount of negative energy, I define the total amount of negative energy as the integral of the stress energy density in all the regions that is negative. Okay? The total amount scales like sigma to the n minus 1. And that means that I can have as much total negative energy as I want. The price to pay, though, is that I have to make it really thin, as we saw before. That's a foundational principle. You cannot do better than that. In fact, we studied how optimal this is. And even though I don't show you here, it violates quantum inequalities optimally. In fact, saturates the inequality becomes an equality for this if you do the optimal scaling. And it also saturates the scaling of the quantum interest conjecture as well, the amount of positive energy around it. So QET is also, the accelerated mirror does too. Huh? So it's not like QET is much better than the accelerated mirror on that, but it's not a huge mirror. We're talking about microscopic atoms that you can address perhaps individually in some future, I don't know, in a century or two or something. Make sense? All right, so now let's summarize what I have and let's talk about solid space time, just one slide, and I promise that's it. We saw that QET can be used to operationally generate negative energy distributions. And it does so consuming space-like vacuum entanglement. That's the resource that we're using, the fact that the ground state of the field has space-like entanglement. Now, of course, the negative energy packets are accompanied by positive energy packets. This is actually interesting. The kind of, if you get one of those exotic solutions, like the warp drive, the Alcubierre warp drive, and ask what is the stress energy distribution for those, are exactly like this. So that's nice. And then QET, the scaling saturates the quantum interest conjecture and violates the average weak energy condition optimally. Now, of course, one thing is tailoring. The nice thing is, though, the distributions that we want is just only conditioned by your ability to address the cloud of atoms and where you're able to put those atoms. By putting those atoms, you have the shapes of the distributions. Now, of course, one thing is creating stress energy density, negative stress energy in flat space-time with no reaction whatsoever. For real, who knows, if you activate Einstein equations, maybe they dissipate that negative energy very badly, maybe they react badly on the system. So one actually needs to do this in a dynamical space-time, in which you start from flat space-time and do the protocol and see how space-time reacts to it. And that's something that we have not started, but are about to start to work with. Here we have Boris. Sorry, I know your name very well, but I always say Bruno for some reason. Well, I know the reason, because Bruno. That always happened in my mind, wants to say Bruno, but sorry about that. Boris, Rick, and Boris is a master student that just started. Rick is a PhD student. You are, you know, you should follow him. An extremely brilliant PhD student, I would say. There are not that many like him in quality. And this we're going to work with Eric Snetter, who's you probably know. He's the person that saves lives here at Perimeter when something goes wrong with computing-related stuff. He's also an expert on numerical relativity and strong gravity. And working together, we hope. We are starting baby steps, so it will take a while. We're starting to see non-trivial gravitation, gravitation of non-trivial quantum states, so things beyond semi-classical gravity. And to begin with, just semi-classical gravity with non-trivial quantum states, but also fluctuations, because those are important to see the stability of this. And we're beginning to explore it, so I don't know, stay tuned if you're interested in it. I think that's pretty much it. Boris Ragula, T. Rick Perch, and Eric Snetter. All right, I think that's pretty much all I have. Yeah, thank you very much.
So in you said that in 3+1 dimensions you need a cloud of atoms.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, the one day for the particular things that we study in 1+1D we use LOQC. LOQC is from one atom to another atom. Now in 3D you could do LOQC, but only from one atom to another atom. If you want to create a distribution in space, you don't really want it to be just one atom. So in 1+1D for the proof of principle we use two atoms if you want. In 3+1D, you want to be able to configure your distribution of negative energy, so you need a bunch of atoms. And of course, you cannot do LOQC to a bunch of atoms, from Alice to a bunch of atoms. That's the problem.
So you cannot also use like a super principle, one atom in a
super position? Oh, maybe you can use that, yeah. We never did it. I guess you could, actually. That would be a hell of a superposition, though, if you want to cover a big area. But yeah, no. That actually may work. Yes. Yeah. You could do that. And then you could do, in that case, LOQC, yeah. Yeah, good point.
I guess in that scheme, you're trying to make a spherical distribution of negative energy. But if you just sent, if you just use LOQC or LOCC to a single atom, could you just create negative energy around that single atom?
That's right.
Check my understanding of the principle behind talking about and ask you if this is just a correct simplification.
Right.
So we know the vacuum is the superposition of entangled Rindler particles.
That's a way that I don't love, but that's a picture that I don't love particularly, but it's fine. That's,
whether you love it or not, it's true. So let's focus on one of those Rindler modes.
Okay.
I'm considering a free field theory.
Yeah.
Which I think you were also. So pick one pair, and the quantum state of that pair is a superposition of all, each Rindler mode has different occupation numbers it can have,
yep.
Right? Number of quanta in that mode. So the state is a superposition of products of different numbers of quanta.
Yep.
Now, Alice is on one side. She measures one Rindler mode, finds some result for the number of quanta that are in it, and sends Bob the information about what she found, like there were 15 quanta in that Rindler mode. Now Bob knows that his partner Rindler mode is in the 15th level, which is above the ground state of that Rindler mode. So he can just design an apparatus that uses a projection operator onto the 15th Rindler level and couples it to whatever he wants, and just extracts that 15 quanta of energy out of that Rindler mode because he knows what it is. If he didn't know that it was in the 15th level, he would have to just apply whatever local operations he has, and he would just find the vacuum. So he couldn't get anything. But knowing that that Rindler quantum is in the 15th level, then since 15 is greater than 0, he has energy available.
Yeah.
Is this exactly what you're saying, or is it missing?
Exactly. So the intuition, I think, is good. The intuition is really good. The issues that I would have with all this, right, is you cannot do projective measurements on Rindler quanta.
Cannot do what?
Projective measurements on Rindler quanta. That violates causality. If you do this basis, if you use this basis, you're assuming that Alice lives in a wedge that is completely causally disconnected from Bob, so the classical information would never be able to arrive. But if instead of thinking of the Rindler basis that you're thinking of, you think of local basis, it would be accurate.
Well, sure. I mean, it's conceptually easy.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean. The intuition is right. Yeah.
Then, of course, we can project onto a smaller, more localized,
yep,
like a fraction of a Rindler mode.
Sure, yeah.
And then degrade the extraction,
yep,
energy, but the basic principle is just that.
I agree. The intuition is a way of visualizing, in particular, fog bases, local fog bases, a way of what's going on here. That's the entanglement. In fact, any decomposition in bipartite bases that reflects that entanglement is going to be able to be used for this, right? Now, I don't like a lot the Rindler one, because that one, again, if you were actually accessing Rindler modes and were able to measure them, which means that you're accelerating in a wedge here, you're accelerating in a wedge here, they cannot communicate, so classical information could...
I don't understand, too.
You
just have an array of devices that spread out over a space-like surface and interacts with all the Rindler modes and just tune it to pick up,
okay,
sensitivity to the Rindler mode you're interested in. It's true, it would be a totally non-local apparatus.
Yeah.
And I can see why you prefer to localize it, but it's not... There's no causality violation or anything like that. You had to set up a device in preparation for this experiment, you know, that was spread out over a lot of space.
So again, the intuition, I think, is good. I can explain the reason why I'm typically allergic. Maybe it's my fault. But in RQI, in relativistic quantum information, precisely the ability to localize measurements is very important and crucial for most of these protocols. So maybe it's a prejudice of mine. Every time that we talk about an intuition on non-local basis, because sometimes, not saying this case, but sometimes that gives wrong intuition because of the lack of localization. I'm pretty allergic to that. That's why. But the intuition is right. It's literally, you can think of it as measurements on the local algebra of observables here, on the local algebra of observables here. And because that entanglement exists, of course, measuring something here informs you on what you need to do here in order to, in general, you would not be able to, if you do random operations, you're not going to extract energy. But if you know exactly what's going on here, you know exactly in what direction of the phase space of this picture observable to make a displacement, for example, and try to push it back. You see, let me just write a phase space picture that I love for this. That is your intuition, huh? But phase space. So imagine that you have the ground state, say it's a Gaussian. We're talking, this is for a harmonic oscillator, but again, think of a free theory, free scalar theory. Now, of course, Alice is going to make a measurement, and that measurement pushes the ground state here. Now, the ground state is going to start rotating. Now, if Bob starts doing things randomly, in general, it's not going to decrease the energy of the state. It's not going to get it any closer to the ground state. However, if Alice tells Bob the outcome of that measurement, then you can have some information about that angle, and then Bob knows exactly how to push it to get it as close back to the ground state as possible from his side. Of course, it's not going to be exactly, because he doesn't have access to the same algebra, but he has access to some algebra that can do similar operations, which is, again, it's not different from what you said. But I'm typically allergic to use non-local basis. Again, put it on me, because there's something in RQI typically very important. The measurement problem in QFT is a big deal. Yeah. And localization is the main issue with it, yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good intuition. So looking above the prejudice I may have against that way of thinking, the intuition is on point, yeah. Yeah.
If not, then let's thank Eduardo again for his time.
Thank you.